Okay, shall we, let's carry on a little bit. So let's move on to the next disadvantage or drawback. Furthermore, for the sake of sensual pleasures, kings fight with kings. Aristocrats fight with aristocrats. Brahmins fight with Brahmins. Householders fight with householders. Mother fights with her child. A child with her mother, with its mother. Father with child. Child with father. Brother fights with brother. Brother with sister. Sister with brother. Friends fight with friends. Yeah? Anyone fights with anyone. I think that's kind of the bottom line here. And this is true, isn't it? We fight over things in the world. We disagree about things. And whenever we fight, it is almost always about sensual pleasures. There's one other reason why we fight, apart from sensual pleasures. And that has to do with ego, with our sense of self. Yeah, this is the other thing. Yeah? But sensual pleasures is a big one. And that is often, we want the same things in the world. We are kind of competing over scarce resources, as I said before. And that that competition of a scarce resource, it means that we argue, we fight, and we kind of cause all kind of problems because of that. Kings fight with kings. Yeah, I want your kingdom too. My kingdom is not big enough. That's kind of a nice sutta. This is the Ratapala Sutta. Do you know the Ratapala Sutta? Beautiful sutta. I recommend you to read it. And at the end of the Ratapala Sutta, it has what they call the four summaries of the Dhamma. It's in the middle-length sayings of Buddha number 82 in the middle-length sayings, Ratapala Sutta. And Ratapala is this young man who goes forth and becomes a monastic. And then later on in his life, he comes back to his hometown, and he meets the king of that hometown. And he teaches the king what is called the four summaries of the Dhamma, very beautiful summaries that kind of really encompass the Dhamma in a very beautiful way here. And one of those summaries is that the world is a slave to craving. The world is insatiate. There's no satisfaction in the world. The world is a slave to craving. And then the king asked Ratapala, what do you mean by that? This is the summary of the Dhamma, right? A slave to craving. Yeah. The king asked him, what do you mean by that? And then Ratapala says, well, let me ask you in return, great king. Yeah, if there is a man comes from the east, and the man says to you, there's a big kingdom in the east, lots of gold and silver, elephants and cattle, all this wealth, but it is not protected very well. You can take it if you wish. What would you do, great king? And the king says, of course, we would take it. We would conquer it. Of course, right? It's obvious, isn't it? So, well, why even ask the question? It's kind of, you know, and if another man came from the south, from the north, from the west, from overseas, what would he do? Well, we'll take that as well. Huh? And then he says, well, that's what we mean. The world is insatiate. It doesn't matter how large your kingdom is. If it can get larger, you will take it. And I always ask myself, where is the limit? What if you own the whole earth? What next? Well, after the earth, you will want Mars, right? Then you will want Venus. Then you will want the next solar system. Then you will want the whole galaxy. One galaxy, not enough, nowhere near enough. Okay, the next galaxy, the supercluster, 1,000 galaxies, not sufficient, right? The whole universe. Well, what if you have the whole universe? And this is my theory. My theory is that, you know, these days they have this idea of multiple universes. Have you heard of the multiverse? Yeah? This is why the multiverse was invented. Because it was not enough with one universe, right? The greed was so large. You want more universes. So even more universes without end. And this is the problem with craving. And the reason why craving has this problem is because craving can never be satisfied. It can never be satisfied by having more. It's always going to go further. And for that reason, that actually there is no limit to the idea for, you know, what you can crave for. And so this is really the problem here. This is the issue, is this idea that you are insatiate. Satiation, satisfaction doesn't happen in that world. It happens somewhere else. It happens within by practicing and thinking in the right way. So it goes on. Kings fight with kings. Yeah, more and more. I want what you have. You know, don't take what I have. And then you fight and all these kind of things. And the world is full of this. And when you see many of the wars that happen in the world, they happen for these kind of reasons. Some of the wars in the Middle East, I think, are wars over oil. Yeah, I want to control the resources of oil in the world. I think that is often at least a part of it. That is sensual pleasures. I don't know. It's interesting. What about the war in Ukraine? Is that a war for sensual pleasures? I think maybe a little bit, but I think also it has to do with identity, the sense of self. Yeah, I think this idea that, you know, when you hear what some of these leaders say, like Vladimir Putin, he says, this is the natural backyard of Russia. This belongs to us. There's a feeling that this is ours already. This we deserve this, right? And this has to do more with a sense of self, perhaps, than the thing. So you can see that these wars and these problems, they arise from these two things. Sense objects and the sense of self, the idea. This is kind of where almost everything can be analyzed back to those two things. Okay, connecting, it says over here. Huh? Connecting here. Ah, I think I lost my internet connection. Oh, it's still there. Huh? Okay. Ooh.
Oh.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Ding. Okay. So, let's go on to the next one. Okay, here we go. Once they started quarreling, arguing, and disputing, they attack each other with fists, stones, rods, and swords, resulting in death or deadly pain. This, too, is a drawback of sensual pleasures apparent in this very life, a mass of suffering caused by sensual pleasures. This is the thing that we saw before in that sutta on the Atadanda Sutta, yeah, the taking up of punishment and weapons and arms that we saw before. This idea that the world is always fighting, there's no place, you cannot get away from the fighting and the conflict in the world. It's built into the world. It's built into sensual pleasures. And that's why it is called a mass of suffering, because it's always around, always lurking in the background, waiting to come out in the future again. It's like the cause and conditions are building up behind the scenes. You can't see it happening. And then it emerges out. And then you have these conflicts happening in the world. It's like no one could see the war in Ukraine coming, but behind the scenes it was building up, and then suddenly it reaches a critical momentum and it comes out, and everything in the world is a bit like that. Okay. Furthermore, for the sake of sensual pleasures, they don their sword and shield. Don is like put on. Fasten their bow and arrows and plunge into the battle. Massed on both sides, with arrows and spears flying and swords flashing. Yeah. Sounds like some kind of movie. Yeah. Where they are struck with arrows and spears, their heads are chopped off, resulting in death or deadly suffering. Well, I think if your head is chopped off, it's more than deadly suffering or deadly pain. I think you're in trouble. Now, this too is a drawback of sensual pleasures apparent in this very life, a mass of suffering caused by sensual pleasures. And sometimes you have no choice. You get sent into war whether you want to or not. What happens if Malaysia goes to war? What happens then? Who has to go to war? Is there any? But what if the army is not big enough? And then you have to get reservists. Start drafting people, right? The men, not the women. But what if the men is not enough? It's interesting because in some countries they have the draft, a military service also for women. Yeah, like in Israel they also have a military for women. So if the men is not enough, the women have to go. Not safe just because you're a woman, you know. Yeah, I'm just trying to bring out the Dhamma here. Yeah. And then if you're old, if everyone else is used up, they take the old people as well, right? Even if you are over 60, say, okay, only, not 70 yet, okay, come, we're going to take you in. And so so this is kind of what happens. We think there's not going to be war, but before you know it, there's a war. Yeah. Who is Malaysia most likely to go to war with? What is the most likely country? Singapore? Your victim? Who is the aggressor? The US and China. It's true, isn't it? It is the big, when the big powers go into conflict, all the small countries suffer as a consequence. It's true, isn't it? The whole world suffers when the big powers get into conflict. It is very true. So we should go to the big powers and tell them off. It's like... You get your head chopped off if you do that. Maybe it's worth it. Yeah. What was that? Missile, yeah. But it is. It is not a joke. You think it's a joke. It's not a joke. Yeah. There's a story with back in the time of when Ajahn Brahm was in Thailand. He was the disciple of Ajahn Chah, and because at that time the Vietnam War was going on, yeah, and Thailand was also partly involved with the Vietnam War, and there was problems in Cambodia, of course, and all these kind of things. And there was a monk who was drafted by the army, and so he went to Ajahn Chah. I'm a monk. What should I do? I'm drafted by the army. Ajahn Chah said, "You should go." Yeah. And he said, "Well, what if they ask me to shoot someone?" He says, "Just aim above the head." Yeah. So that's kind of so it's not a joke. Yeah. If you are a monastic, yeah, then still they may draft you into the army. So this is actually this happens. So I, not the nuns. This is called denial. This is called denial, yeah? Don't want to hear about reality. So this is what the Buddha said. Denial is no good. Okay, but anyway, yeah, you can see how these things are. Actually, they're much more real than we think they are. We think the world is peaceful until suddenly there is no peace anymore. Maybe Switzerland is supposed to be neutral, right? For how long? Yeah? Even though it's been neutral for, 800 years or something like that? Because long way back, even though one day it's going to come to an end, right? We just don't know when it's going to be. When there's no money, when the banks collapse, that's when Switzerland is going to have a problem. The point is that everything is unreliable. Everything is uncertain. Everything is subject to change. We don't know what's going to happen. That's really the point here. And so this is what happens. That is all the things to do with the present life. Is that right, Wayen? Is that the last one? I don't have the book in front of me now. Next, is that the end? Is that the end of the present life? One more paragraph, really? Is that the paragraph on? Furthermore, okay, for the sake of sensual pleasures, they don their sword and shields, fasten their bow and arrows, and charge wetly plastered bastions. Is that the one? With arrows and swords flying and swords flashing. No, you can keep it one. That's okay. I only need that one there. You're going to go already? Yeah. Feeling sleepy? Okay, so you're following my instructions to kind of... Okay. All right. Okay, I'll borrow it then. Very good, huh? Don't tell enough jokes, obviously, you're falling asleep, so I gotta... So you wetly plastered bastions with arrows and spears flying and swords flashing. There they are struck with arrows and spears, splashed with dung, crushed with spiked blocks. Wow, this is kind of scary, isn't it? and the heads are chopped off result in death or deadly suffering here, or death-like suffering here. This too is a drawback of sensual pleasures apparent in this very life, a mass of suffering caused by sensual pleasures. No, it wasn't there. That one wasn't there. This is an additional one here. Yeah, down. So that's what I meant. This was the last one in the present life. The next one is the future life, you see? Yeah. Future life. All right, anyway. So now we have looked at all the ones that have to do with the present life. And of course, once that comes to the end, then comes the problem of sensual pleasures relating to the future life. Furthermore, for the sake of sensual pleasures, they conduct themselves badly by way of body, speech, and mind. When the body breaks up after death, they are reborn in a place of loss, a bad place, the underworld in hell. So this is the big one, right, from sensual pleasures. There's a tendency for people in the world to behave badly because of sensual pleasures. If you look at the large part of the bad things that happen in the world, the bad things that people do, actually it is related to sensual pleasures in one way or another. Sometimes also related to the sense of self, but very often related to sensual pleasures. We do bad things. And the less idea you have of the consequences in the future, like the ideas of rebirth or whatever, and all of these things, and how these things have a very long-term bad effect, the less you have that kind of idea, the more likely you are to focus on the pleasures in this life being the important thing. And regardless of what you have to do to secure the pleasures in this life, you will do that, even if it is doing bad things. Why? Because this is visible here and now. This is all I've got. This is what the meaning of life. You have no sense of the broader vision of reality. And this is very dangerous. But once you open up your mind to this broader vision of reality, once you start reading some of the stories of near-death experiences, once you hear about children having the memories of past lives, once you get a feeling for what this feels like, once you start maybe have these experiences yourself even, and you see that broader thing, you come back, you never are the same person afterwards. You understand the limited appeal of the worldly pleasures of this life. You understand the limited appeal of that because you know the reality is far, far greater. You become more kind when you see the world in that way. And this is this idea that having a feeling for rebirth actually makes you a better person. I find it very astonishing. Sometimes you hear about some of these secular Buddhists and they say, oh, it doesn't matter, you don't have to believe in rebirth because being moral is good regardless. And that the truth is that if you have an idea of the great expanse of life, it has a far more powerful effect on morality than just focusing on this life. It really enhances that. And this is why, as I said before, you find people having these near-death experiences and they come back and they are transformed as people because they understand more about that larger reality. You would never do anything bad simply so that you can get more in this life. Because I want a bigger apartment. I want a bigger car than the neighbor. Yeah, the neighbor has a BMW. It's only 5 series. I want a 7 series BMW, whatever it is. I don't know what these numbers are these days. But we become really, really stupid about these things in this world that actually are not that valuable. And then we start to think about life in an entirely different way. And this is this idea, again, of enhancing the spiritual life, understanding the danger in these things. Never do anything bad in this life in the pursuit of the limited things that belong to this world. If you do something bad in the pursuit of what belongs to this world, there's only one guarantee for you. You're going to regret it when you die. On your deathbed, you're going to say, wow, all of these things I have to give up. Now I'm dying. All I take with me is the bad karma that I made in the pursuit of those things that I have to give up anyway. You can see how crazy that is, right? Everything has to go. Everything, and all you bring with you is the bad conscience, the remorse, the regret of having done bad things in this life. Everything else has to go. It's kind of only on your deathbed you understand how crazy that is, and how you have let yourself down and destroyed your own life because of your own lack of vision, your own lack of confidence in the teachings of the Buddha, or whatever else it might be. So this is really what this is about, and why this is so important. Of course, this is really the big one. It's bad enough in this life, but the consequences for the future are even greater. And I can guarantee you that if you keep on being attached to the sensory realm, eventually you will do at least some bad things in the pursuit of sensual things. Because that is just the nature of the human mind. Sometimes it seems so important. And especially in the areas of love, attachment to other people. This is a very powerful attachment. This is also part of the sensory realm. But if you have a partner who is incredibly dear to you, or your children, of course, are very, very dear to you, you will do almost anything to hold on to that partner, to hold on to those children, to hold on to whatever in that realm. You will do anything, and I can almost guarantee you, that you will also do bad things in the name of holding on to that. We talk often here about things like crimes of passion. Crimes of passion are when you're even willing to kill somebody because you are so immersed in that relationship that if they leave you, you will actually kill them as a consequence. We hear about these things all the time. You go crazy out of attachment and love and desire for other people. This is the reality of the world. So we have to be very, very careful, because we are all subject to these things. We have all been through that. I look back on my own life, I can very well see the kind of attachments, not so much anymore, but certainly in the past, like when I was a layperson. It's a long time ago now, 30 years ago, since I was a layperson. But the memory is very strong still. I know what it feels like to have your heart bound because of a relationship with another person like that. Incredibly powerful and painful and difficult to deal with. We all know those things. So that's why we have to be careful, because we are subject to these things whether we think we are or not. All right. So, this is a drawback of sensual pleasures to do with lives to come, a mass of suffering caused by sensual pleasures. So here now the Buddha has kind of given us this, all these details about sensual pleasures. And then I think the sutta goes on for quite a bit further, but I'm not going to go into that now. It goes into the discussion about jains and all kind of things. But this is the kind of the main thing that I wanted to focus on, to give you an idea. And you can see it's very straightforward, right? It's actually very simple. And the main thing that we have to do, what is hard, is to notice these things in your life, to see that they're actually there. Very often we forget about the downside. We don't want to see it when it happens. And then because of that, we lack that clarity. We lack the honesty to see things squarely as they actually are. So opening up to this is important. And when you start to see that, you start to change your priorities. Your priorities become different, and you focus more on the spiritual aspect of existence. Living well, doing the right thing, having more compassion and understanding in the world. That's why you then move gradually as a consequence. This is the purpose of these kind of teachings, to lead you in the right way. So, we're going to start a new sutta in a second. Maybe this is a good place to stop, rather than, it's only got 5 minutes before the supposed break. So let's take a 5 minute meditation break now, and then we'll come back to the next sutta shortly. Okay, everyone. So, I feel sorry for who? I feel sorry to wake up the person who is snoring a little bit. I would like to leave them in peace to sleep more. Are you okay, Wayne? Are you feeling a bit sick, or are you all right? You don't have to drive. Okay, yeah. Okay, very good. Yeah, please just do whatever you feel is right, you know. So look after yourself. Okay, everyone. So any further questions or comments about this? One over here in the front.
Venerable sir, I have a question on these two things called the five senses and the sense of self. I'm not even sure whether the direction of my question is correct. If not, would request that I be corrected. Which one come first? The five senses come first, and then their working give rise to this sense of self, or there is already the sense of self, then only there is this five senses. How do they correlate with each other? Which one comes first? Yeah. Is this even the right question? Thank you.
They usually come together. You can't really say one comes first, the other one comes afterwards, because they exist together. When there is the five senses, there's always the sense of self. When there's the sense of self, you don't always have the five senses. You can have only one sense, for example. So, for example, if you go into a deep meditation state, the ordinary five senses are gone, only the mind is left. And that mind will also have a sense of self, but there will always be some sense left, yeah, even if it's just the mind. So as long as there is some sense there, not necessarily the five senses, but at least the mind, then there will also be the sense of self. And the sense of self, at the very least, there will be the mind present. It goes together. They cannot exist without each other. If you get rid of the sense of self, then the mind and the five senses will eventually also disappear, will go. They cannot exist without the sense of self. Yeah? Yeah. Please, yeah.
Oh, hi, Dante. May I kindly clarify that if one is go about practicing bhavana, the aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path, and that we have a choice between vipassana or samatha, and specifically the samatha is anapanasati, and if the vipassana, it's let's say the Mahasisarada method, which one would Hachan advise, because
okay,
thinking that setting the right footing,
yeah,
is the right one, and if what does the sutta say about this?
That is exactly the right question. That's the question I wanted to hear. What does the sutta say? That is always the right question to ask. Yeah, it is not the right question. Is Mahasi right or is Goenka right? The right question is what does the sutta say? That's always the right question to ask. So congratulations for at least asking the right question. If you ask the right question, there's a chance that we will get on the right track. So that's wonderful. I'm not going to talk too much about this because this is kind of a little bit beyond what we're doing now. But essentially what the Buddha says is basically he says that anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, fulfills the four satipatthanas. And the four satipatthanas are really what meditation practice is about. So all you have to do is anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing. Yeah. That's all you really have to do. And that is both samatha and vipassana. Remember, one of the things in the modern world, we talk about samatha meditation and vipassana meditation as if there are two kinds of meditation. The Buddha never talks about samatha meditation. He never talks about vipassana meditation. There is no such thing in the suttas. He does talk about samatha. He does talk about vipassana. But these are the results of meditation. They're not methods of meditation. That is a very important distinction. So if you practice mindfulness of breathing, you get two results. Two results are samatha and vipassana. So mindfulness of breathing is both calm and insight, or both calm and clear seeing. And so so what about the Mahasi technique or the Goenka technique? Are they Samatha or Vipassana? Well, if they work, they are both Samatha and Vipassana, because the Samatha Vipassana always has to go together. You cannot have one without the other. Why? Because when you feel calm, you will see clearly. When you see things clearly, because what you are seeing is that you are seeing dukkha, it means you will give up things, you will feel calm as a consequence. Calm and clear seeing is my translation for Vipassana, have to go together. They cannot be distinguished from each other. They must go together. So all you have to do is do meditation practice, and it will give rise to both of those results. And if it doesn't give rise to both, it doesn't give rise to any one of them. That is, as I understand the word of the Buddha. There is a booklet on the internet which is called Why Sammata and Vipassana Are Inseparable. And it is written by a certain monk called Ajahn Brahmali. So check it, search for it on the internet, you will find it, and you can read it, and I go into this in much more detail. Why Sammata and Vipassana are inseparable. Yeah. Yeah.
Ajahn, if there's no other question, I would like to ask, since Ajahn emphasized hammer down on the importance of having faith in the teaching on rebirth, right? And for us lay people, we kind of take that in intellectually.
Yeah.
It's kind of different from knowing that the rebirth for certain.
Yeah,
we can
absolutely
read a lot of books and we can accept the teaching, but then how to say, I don't think it'll be some sort of solid faith, confidence on that. And does Ajahn recommend past life regressions, those sort of things, so that we can actually know for sure that rebirth is actually there?
Yeah, I mean, if you like to play around in that area and you think it's fun, you can do past life regression. Yeah, but remember, the results are very uncertain with past life. We are very, very uncertain, and a lot of the time it's just the mind confabulating things, because the mind is full of dreams and ideas and images and all this kind of stuff. Most of the time it is useless. Sometimes it may lead to something positive. So if you are interested and think it might be good fun, you can do it. But don't do it and think that you're going to get confirmation for past lives. You're not going to get that. Except maybe in some cases. There are some exceptional cases where it may happen. But I think for me, it is more powerful just to read some of the stories of people, you know, the stories you hear about people, like the book I was mentioning the other day, the book called After. And that sort of thing. And when I read these books and I hear ordinary people talk about their experiences, it's very hard for me to dismiss it. This book was written by the scientist called Bruce Grayson, and he goes through all the various kinds of explanations. And he says that at the end of this whole thing, going through all the various explanations, there is a residue that cannot really be explained away. Yeah, it's very, very hard to come up with an explanation for these things. And so to me, these things are, why should we not think it has to do with rebirth? Yeah, to me, it's kind of the reason why there is so much resistance is not because the evidence is bad. The reason why there is so much resistance is because our culture leans against it, goes against it. If you were living in a culture where rebirth was accepted, this will be taken as evidence straight away. But because our culture actually goes against these things, we set a very high bar for the kind of evidence that we accept. Yeah, and sometimes too high. I know that some of the evidence that was collected by Ian Stevenson with the recollection of, you know, children recollecting past lives, some of the people who looked at it said this is a much higher standard of evidence than almost in any other science. But still it gets rejected, and the reason is because the cultural bias against these kind of things. And this is what makes it difficult sometimes. I think that we just need to, I guess, one of the nice things that I would really love to hear, if anyone here has had any experiences like that. If you feel like writing it down and you want to be anonymous, that's perfectly fine. But it would be wonderful, and especially if in in your Buddhist community, you can talk about these things. Because once you start to hear these stories from people around you, yeah, who've had something like this, it starts to open up your mind in a new way. Because these are people you can trust. These are people you know. If it happens to your family members, yeah, or especially, of course, if it happens to yourself, then it's very different. But talking about these things, and actually really listening to people, see what's going on with them, actually can be very, very interesting. Sometimes we are afraid of opening up about these things because we think other people are going to think we are nuts. We are kind of really crazy here. But that's terrible when that happens. Yeah, like we are afraid to talk about these things because actually they can be very, very useful to open up our minds to something larger. So just, I would encourage, just keep on looking. On the internet, there are some great stories. There's a beautiful story. You may have heard of Anita Morjani, a very famous story. She was in Hong Kong, and she living in Singapore in Hong Kong. She was an Indian descent. And she had this very powerful near-death experience that completely transformed her life. She became a completely different person afterwards. Very inspiring. She gave a TED talk on that later on. And it's on TED, been viewed by millions of people, Anita Morjani. So there are many things like that that are very, very fascinating. And after a while, it becomes kind of almost second nature. Of course there is rebirth. Why don't we believe in this? Well, we only don't believe in it because it goes against so much of our contemporary culture. It's just the bias that we have in our culture. And that is the biggest problem, I think.
Thank you, Ajahn.
Yeah. All right, so now it is 2:30. What does that mean? I lost my track here. We have a break. Okay, let's have a break. Yeah.